Yksi. Kaksi. Kolme. Neljä. Viisi.
Ota LähiTapiolan henkivakuutus ja lepäät rauhassa. Henkivakuutuksen myöntää LähiTapiola keskinäinen henkivakuutusyhtiö. LähiTapiola. Samalla puolella.
The Beatlesin sisäpiirin yksi uskollisimmista jäsenistä oli roudari Mal Evans, joka oli mukana matkalla tähtiin sen katkeraan loppuun saakka. Kun Mal näki bändin esiintyvän ensi kertaa Cavern Clubin lavalla, oli hän siitä lähtien myyty osaksi menestystarinaa. Mal oli roudarina, mutta myös henkivartijana. Hän huolehti turvallisuudesta, mutta myös kaikesta, mitä Beatlesit tarvitsivat. Get Back-elokuvassa nähty lempeä jättiläinen on nyt saanut arvoisensa huomion, kun professori Kenneth Womack kirjoitti hänestä marraskuussa 2023 ilmestyneen kirjan Living the Beatles Legend. Kuuntelet siis Beatlecastia, puhetta Beatlesista, äänessä on Mika Lintu sekä Mikko Kangasjärvi. Ken Womack on yksi maailman johtavimpia Beatles-asiantuntijoita. Hän on kirjoittanut lukuisia kirjoja yhtyeestä ja sen ympäriltä, muun muassa kaksiosaisen teoksen tuottaja George Martinista sekä kirjan John Lennonin viimeisestä vuodesta. Living the Beatles Legend sai alkunsa, kun Mal Evansin poika Gary Evans otti häneen yhteyttä ja pyysi häntä kertomaan vuonna 1976 traagisesti kuolleen isänsä tarinan. Kenneth kiinnostui heti, sillä Mal oli jättänyt jälkeensä päiväkirjoja, valokuvia, elävää kuvaa sekä valmiin käsikirjoituksen elämäkertaansa varten. Nyt tästä kaikesta on syntynyt kirja, jossa on ennennäkemätöntä materiaalia Mal Evansin ja Beatlesien elämästä. Kenneth Womack opettaa englantia ja populaarimusiikkia Monmouthin yliopistossa New Jerseyssä. Womack oli Tampere Beatles Happeningin kunniavieraana elokuussa 2023, jolloin tämäkin haastattelu on tehty. Tämä on ensimmäinen osa kaksiosaista haastattelua. Mitä mieltä Ken Womack on ylipäätänsä siitä, että populaarimusiikkia tutkitaan yliopistotasolla?
Well, you said it. It's issues of high and low culture, right?
Yes.
And you know, every genre has those kinds of designations, and I think we're a lot shrewder about that at this point in the history of higher education, and we understand that in popular music there's high and low culture, and the Beatles are obviously the Shakespeare of popular music and popular culture. They are the high culture of rock and roll, right? So I don't know that we should have a course on REO Speedwagon. Not to pick on those guys. I like them. Or Journey, even, which is a favorite of my wonderful dean, Dean Dave. But the Beatles are worthy of that level of study. They created a body of work. They've created an enduring and very thoughtful, high-minded music. You know, they were artists. So I find it very easy to defend. I'm not even sure we have to defend it anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, the secret is this. And I tell my students this or their parents if they press me. But the truth is, it's just art appreciation, right? If whether I'm teaching Picasso or Shakespeare or the Beatles, I'm giving them a vocabulary and a terminology for how to think in deeper ways about all of this culture we consume. You know, our students, even more than us, and we consume a lot of popular culture, right, with episodic television series and movies and music, etc., they're consuming even more. And so I do believe that all of us should have a working vocabulary to understand why, you know, watching one movie has a deeper emotional and intellectual impact than another, or why one band is worthy of study and others, while they may be interesting and give us pleasure, are not as high-minded.
Mm. Yes. Just as a side note, who else do you consider worth studying the popular music?
In popular music, I would think, you know, off the top of my head, certainly You know, you can make a good argument that Elvis is important and deserving. At my previous institution at Penn State, we had permanent courses on Elvis. I think that my students are very interested in courses on Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. I think you could make a case with Pink Floyd's case, with their political critique and their attempt to create these highly visual soundscapes, that they would be worthy. Led Zeppelin, to my mind, maybe the Doors, come the closest to the Beatles to creating a body of work that has a beginning and an end, you know, for various circumstances, certainly. You know, an interesting exception, I could see teaching a course on the Rolling Stones, but their output is so uneven, right? You know, they have those albums with Jimmy Miller, I guess Beggar's Banquet, Sticky Fingers, Exile on Main Street. Those are just masterworks. Let It Bleed. I can't believe I didn't say that, right? Let It Bleed. Those are masterworks. And that, to me, is the height of their creative powers. But then they go on to have another 20 years of ups and downs, you know. So I find them challenging to teach, right? I would find them challenging, although, again, that middle period is just phenomenal. Maybe their early period through that is their heyday, through the end of their Jimmy Miller years, maybe even ending with Some Girls, yeah. Right? I could see teaching that. But I would be looking for artists that have a body of work. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was John Lennon who said that. I'm sure you both read that at one point. He said, we're recognizing that we have a body of work. It was around the time they did Glass Onion. You know, and we often treat that song very flippantly, you know, like it's a bit of a, just a one-off. But John was being very smart with it. You know, name-checking various Beatles songs, right? As we know, but then ending with that idea about meta-poetry, trying to make a dovetail joint. I remember when I was a kid, I thought, I'm going to get in trouble. This sounds like they're talking about weed, you know, and my parents are going to hear this. But of course, the second my dad heard that, he didn't think that at all. He was a carpenter, and he said, oh, no. He said, that's about making fine furniture, right? You know, weak furniture doesn't have dovetail joints, and your bookcases sag when you start to put any kind of weight on them. A dovetail joint is made to last, right? And the Beatles were making music that's made to last. They were trying to make a dovetail joint. What a great line, because it means I'm trying to build something that has engineering to it.
Yeah.
It has nothing, you know, had nothing to do with weed. I was worried about nothing. It was all about engineering something that would stand the test of time. And what other songs do we have in that period? We have Across the Universe, which is about language and words filling up, you know, the ether and coming to us and creating language and songs and poetry. I mean, he was so plugged in 1968. He really understood, maybe sadly, had the finest year of his life in a lot of ways. You know, he was really out there thinking deeply about music and what craft was.
Mm. Yes, indeed.
One of the reasons why you were here, you are working on a project about Mel Evans, who was a roadie of the Beatles. But if you say that he was a roadie of the Beatles, that's putting him down, because he was much more than that.
Oh, yes. He was... I have a slide that I built very early on in this project to try to capture all of the things he does, right? He's a fixer, you know. He's he'll be a lyricist if you want him to. You know, there was nothing he wouldn't do for them. I mean, there's a famous anecdote. It's around late 1963 when they did their first European tour, and George lost his coat, and Mal just runs off. He leaves the boat they're in a canal because they see one like it. So Mal goes off to chase down a new coat for George. I mean, they couldn't believe it. He would do stuff like that. You know, there was no job too small for Mal Evans. And so he literally did anything they wanted. Mm.
Let's go to the very beginning. Mal.
That kid right now, he needs Mal. ladies and gentlemen, Mal would be taking care of that baby. Yes. He was very good with kids. There's nothing Mal wouldn't do. I mean, he really would. He was wonderful in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
He was really spectacular. And he made himself in a way, I guess, what's the word? Indisposable. He was indispensable. You could not get rid of Mal. But he also did everything with such love and care that he won them all over.
Tell us a little bit about who Mal was. Where did he come from? Why did he join the Beatles organization in the early stages?
He worked for the British Post Office. He had a great career going. He was a telecommunications engineer, and what an exciting time, frankly, to be part of that. You know, that was sort of the nascent analog period where we were beginning to use technology in terms of the post office, in terms of the telephone system, etc. And Mal was just part of it, and it was no easy job. He had to go for 2 years of training to understand the work. You know, it was highly technical. He had a great thing going, but like a lot of folks, he ran into these guys, these Beatles, you know, other Liverpudlians had the same experience, you know. Mal was slightly older than him. He was 5 years older than John Lennon, for example, and Ringo. Another great example of a guy who couldn't look away was Stu Sutcliffe, right? Stu met them. Stu wrote to his sister because she said, "Why aren't you studying art? You know, that's what you're good at." He goes, "Yeah, but I want to see what's going to happen with these guys. You know, I won't quit the art, but I want to see what's going to." And Mal was the same way. He went down to the cavern. He heard their sound, and he kind of wanted to see what was going to happen. You know, everybody had a feeling about them. I don't think any of them would have been surprised if nothing had happened and they hadn't been successful. That was in the cards, too. But there was something special about them, and Mal just wanted to know what it was going to be. So he spent a good 2 years hanging out at the cavern before he had any kind of permanent job.
But he was into music. I mean, he loved Elvis, and was he trying to get a musical career, or was he thinking about that?
So I do believe from some commentary here and there that Mal had dreams of being a kind of star in his own right. You know, he knew that he was kind of big and lovable. He'd played the comic when he was growing up. The kids called him Hippo because he was so big. And Mal took it as a compliment, even though it probably always wasn't always a compliment. He liked to be the life of the party. He did study guitar for a while. He liked to sing. Apparently had a pretty good voice. I know there are a couple of recordings that he did. He sang a version of It Don't Come Easy and another version of a song by The Scaffold. Thank you very much. I have not been able to track these down, so if anybody knows where they are, please let me know. I think he kind of wanted some kind of career of his own. In the last month of his life, he talked a little bit about making an album. He said nothing else about it, and no one else had anything to say. One of the arguments that his wife made against him joining the Beatles in 1963 on a permanent basis was, she said, and it was very cryptic and interesting, "You don't need them to be a star. You've already got that charisma," or whatever that something is. So I think that maybe privately he had suggested that maybe by hooking up with these guys, he could create something for himself. But I have just told you everything I know about any kind of ambitions he may have had.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, he loved being in their films. He jumped at the chance to have that more extended role in the Help film. So I think we have to take that at its face value.
Mm, yes. But eventually he was a bouncer at Cavern. What does it mean? What was his job?
So his job was to, you know, man the door. So if you came in, you had to go through Mal to get into the club.
And he threw people out.
And he would, necessary. Yeah. If I don't think he very threw many people out. Okay. So I mean, Mal was a teddy bear. He just looked menacing because he was so big. And you know, the Beatles weren't, so he looked like this giant of a man. Mm. And he fulfilled that role quite well. I think he only got in one. He had two physical encounters ever. In one case, this guy was accosting George Harrison at the Olympia Theater in Paris in January 1964, and Mal decked him and then felt immediately bad about it. But the guy was really, you know, to quote the 1970s, cruising for a bruising, right? The other time was someone who was way out of line. But otherwise, Mal really didn't do anything physical. He wasn't a violent guy. He was a teddy bear. Alan White, the great drummer for Yes, and of course the Plastic Ono Band, played on Imagine. He told me that Mal was the least violent person he ever met. I think probably the closest he got to needing to be violent was in Manila in the summer of 1966, but things turned a different way in that case. But so a bouncer's job was to just be the heavy at the door. Fortunately, he never really had to do anything like that. What he did do was go get equipment. You know, I mean, that was his job too. So the Cavern being a kind of tricky place, when they would need to bring a new amp or Paul's big coffin amp for his bass, Mal would be the guy to sort of pick it up and haul it down those crazy stairs into the basement there. But that was, you know, it was just a way to be around the bands. It was, yeah, George Harrison's idea. He said, if you do this, then you can just come backstage whenever you want. You can hang out with us. And I imagine by then Mal had a kid, so he probably kind of needed a reason. Mm-hmm. Right? What do you tell your wife? You know, I know you've got the baby at home, but I'm going to go listen to rock and roll every night.
Yes.
And I'm going to go every day at my lunch hour to the Cavern. So he was getting a little bit of money then, and it sort of justified it, because I'm sure by, you know, even though Mal was doing really well, he had a car, he had a home, he was the first in his family to do so. You know, a little extra money doesn't hurt when you have a kid, right?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You know, so I think that probably helped him make the argument to his wife that his time was being well spent. Although, quickly, you know, Lily was kind of a rock chick. She loved music. And very quickly, it turned into a situation where the Cavern and the Beatles were sort of part of their social life. So, you know, Mal would go over to George's house for dinner and stay up all night playing records. Or George would come to Mal's place on Hillside Road in Liverpool and listen to music. And eventually everybody was coming around, you know. Even when, especially when they moved to London in the mid-1960s, the Beatles and their friends would come by Mal's house, you know, Mal and Lily's place. So they were very social people.
Did he also move to London at the same time as the others?
So he and Neil did move to London in 63 with the Beatles, but they lived in a kind of temporary housing. You know, I mean, today they'd be like hotel suites, yeah, that you rent, you know, for extended stays. I think that's the phrase. So they would stay in this kind of extended housing. Neil was in a relationship with Mona Best, of course, and had his son Rogue up in Liverpool. Mal had his family up in Liverpool. So they would do this kind of exhausting routine where they would tend to the Beatles when they weren't on tour. But then maybe on the weekends they would jump in the van and they would go to Liverpool and see their, you know, significant others and families, and then they'd come back Sunday or Monday and do it all again. But that got really tiring. Eventually, they got a nicer place where they stayed. And then Mal bought a house in London, outside of London. And eventually, Neil and Mona break up, and Neil moves to London permanently, too.
What do you know, what was the early days when Mal was a roadie and the Beatles were... They are on the verge of a big break, but not yet. What was their life on the road?
So Mal's it breaks down in very interesting ways, and I was kind of surprised about this. Because Mal's not full-time till August 1963, I mean, a lot of water's under the bridge at that point. They have two number one songs. So by the time Mal's full-time, they're a big deal, right? But the windscreen incident in January 1963, they are on the cusp of fame at that point. So Mal's with them. He would go to some shows. He was still bouncing. Things were getting a little bit more sporadic, though, before he came on board full time. You know, Mal would drive the van or haul the equipment around, or they did those cruises on the Mersey River. Do you remember those? They had Mersey River cruises, and Mal would do some of those, which meant hauling.
Yksi, kaksi, kolme, neljä, viisi.
Ota LähiTapiolan henkivakuutus ja lepäät rauhassa. Henkivakuutuksen myöntää LähiTapiola keskinäinen henkivakuutusyhtiö. LähiTapiola, samalla puolella.
Vihdoinkin. Aika tehdä kesämuistoja. Tallenna kesän parhaat hetket kuvatuotteisiin helposti. Tilaa ennen 19. heinäkuuta ja saat ilmaisen toimituksen yli 10 euron ostoksille. Ifolor.fi.
LähiTapiola tuntee kotien riskit. Saat nyt 30% alennuksen kodin irtaimiston vakuutuksesta. Lue lisää LähiTapiola.fi. Palvelun tarjoajat, LähiTapiolan alueyhtiöt. LähiTapiola, samalla puolella.
Equipment to the ferry and then getting it onto the ferry and setting it up. So, I mean, the reason he came on board is it was killing Neil. Neil was a very slight person, and he was losing weight. I think he weighed like 120 pounds or something like that at some point. He was just a wreck. It was killing him. And he said, I need help. And the logical guy was Mal. You know, he was a person they could trust, and he had proven himself. So, I mean, there is some talk that other people were asked to do the job. Other people wanted the job. But it was really Mal's to turn down. He was the guy. The thing about the early days with Mal and the Beatles is that they were all learning these jobs. These jobs didn't exist. You know, it's funny how, I mean, our other guest this weekend, Chris Thomas, he was inventing his job. Everybody was inventing their jobs. They didn't really exist. I mean, nobody called George Martin a producer, right? He was an A&R man, you know? So all of these jobs sort of had to be invented, and Mal and Neil were inventing theirs. They just needed to invent more people, because the problem was, as they would go on those early tours and really ride on through the last day at Candlestick Park in August 1966, they were the only two guys. You know, they needed, you know, now what, how many guys does Paul McCartney take on tour now? 600? I mean, it's crazy, you know, and you need them.
Yes.
You really do, because of the stage is elaborate. Mal at the end was not only roadieing for the Beatles, he would roadie for the other acts on the bill. But nobody knew any better. You know, they didn't have guitar techs. They had Mal. It was just a different world. So a lot of what they were doing was learning by doing. And even in 1966, you know, when they were doing that last American tour, things would go horribly and quite sillily wrong. It was just silly. You know, he still would find that a local police force would send two cops to a Beatles concert. And it was crazy because, you know, Mal would tell them, guys, things are getting rough. As Beatlemania increased into those later moments, it got violent. You know, so there were the Cow Palace, for example, Some of the fans were throwing folding chairs into the audience and hitting other kids. I mean, it was violent. And there are scenes after that show, the last two shows at the Cow Palace, where Mal is tending to wounded kids. You know, they needed more people to help out. So it was all learning by doing. They were having these experiences where they were having to invent ways to deal with the challenges.
It's incredible to think that nothing worse happened during those crazy
days. Oh, my God. It, in all sorts of ways, yes. Right? I mean, yes. The Beatles were very ill prepared to handle female fans, right? Yeah. They were very excited by them. But, you know, there could have been incidents that could have sunk them. Very easily.
Yes.
Again, because they only had two guys, sort of protecting them. The violence could have ended up... It's amazing nobody died, including one of them. You know, especially in 1966, after the controversy over the Beatles are bigger than Jesus and all of that business. I mean, it was really quite remarkable. And or taking a stand on racism and segregation in 1964. Mm. It's a wonder that... You're right, that something bigger or more salacious didn't happen.
Because all the signs were there.
Oh, they were all there.
It is actually a miracle that nothing happened.
Maybe so, but maybe, I love talking about this when I teach the class. Not that I'm trying to teach the students to get away with something, right? But, but you know, the Beatles had what we call a good press. You know, so by going in the famous Pan Am Lounge interview where they're so clever and they're like, you know, how do you get to America? You turn left at Greenland, and they're being really funny. And, you know, do you guys ever get haircuts? And George Harrison's like, I actually got one today, you know. All of the fun that they were having, they endeared themselves to the lead reporters in the United States. And then they took a train down to Washington, D.C. for that first show. You know, they weren't on tour, but they did a couple of shows. They did Carnegie Hall. And they really ingratiated themselves to the press. It was a brilliant stroke. There's wonderful footage of Ringo with all the reporters' cameras around his neck. And he's kind of lopping around. He's playing the fool. All that stuff was brilliant. Because when it came... And Ringo said, he goes, I was doing it because I knew they wanted to kill us. They wanted to destroy them. These are young guys with all this fame and girls and success. You know, they were perfect for, you know, kicking off the pedestal. But they were very smart. You know, they won these guys over. They made sure that the press loved them. So in 65 and 66, when things get rough, there they are.
Yeah.
You know, the press could have gone much harder on the Beatles and didn't.
Yeah.
It was a master stroke.
You cannot put yourself in Mal's shoes, Will.
No, they're too big for me.
Yes, they're too big for anybody of us. But if you think about the pressure which was going on for years about him taking care of them, the boys, taking care of the fans, taking care of... I think... do you know anything that... Does it take any toll? I mean...
Absolutely it did, and that's a shrewd question because, Mal in pictures and video comes off like a happy-go-lucky guy, and he was fun-loving, that's true, you know.
Yeah.
Kids would, while Mal would be at Abbey Road in the car park, kids would play soccer with him, you know, they had so much fun. But Mal did take that very seriously and lived in a lot of fear about something happening to them or not satisfying them. I mean, he never forgave himself for not having guitar picks when they were with Elvis. I mean, he never forgot that. You know, that they're coming for us.
Yes. They're coming to take me away.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think they're coming for you guys. I'm innocent. Anyway, Mal was deeply fearful, you know, of not satisfying them or meeting their needs or something really big happening.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were a lot of scares, as you alluded to along the way. I mean, Manila alone, right?
Yeah.
They could have been killed very easily.
Yeah, exactly.
or had permanent injuries. So he lived in a lot of fear about that, you know.
Of course, you know, things change for everybody when Beatles stop touring. What about Mal? How did he take the role?
Yeah, he and Neil were kind of wondering at that point, what's going to happen? Yeah. You know, George Harrison was. Remember, he says, I'm not a Beatle anymore, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
They were kind of wondering what would happen. But we're not surprised when the Beatles wholeheartedly, particularly Lennon and McCartney at those early days, but wholeheartedly became a studio band, which actually meant they were doing more work because, you know, now they weren't stationary in hotels all together on the road. Now they have four different residences. Mal and Neil have their own residences. And so their lives actually become more complicated after the touring days end, because now they're on call all of the time. When Mal and Lily bought their house, they picked it so that it was only a few minutes away from Esher, where George lived, and then Weybridge, where John and Ringo lived in their estates. And what it meant was that it was easier for them. Mal was more equidistant between them. The complicated one was in getting to Paul and Abbey Road, but at least those were near each other, right? So that was good. So really, life became more complicated because now, you know, the Beatles have social lives, you know. They still didn't have bodyguards, though, amazingly, just Mal. You know, today they would all have a team of security, right? And hopefully do have security.
What about his friendship with all the Beatles? Was he closer to somebody than somebody else?
He was. There was a lot of jealousy about who kind of got Mal. There really was. I mean, he was kind of Paul's guy for a while. He lived with Paul at Cavendish Avenue, even though his family lived near Paul. By then, Mal's family lived in London. But there was some jealousy. You know, they all wanted, everybody wants a Mal. I need a Mal, you know, and we all do. I recommend it, right? We all need some kind of Mal who's just there for us in that kind of moving way. But, his friendships developed differently with them. For a long time, he didn't quite know what to do with John Lennon, you know, the kind of acerbic humor. But they became very, very close. After Paul, Mal and George became very, very close. He always loved Ringo, you know. But he loved Pete Best before Ringo. He was good friends with Pete Best. He was quite upset when Pete was fired. You know, and Pete felt the same way about Mal. He loved him.
Yeah. Kiitos, että kuuntelit Beatlecastia, puhetta Beatlesista. Kenneth Womackin haastattelun toinen osa julkaistaan seuraavassa Beatlecastin jaksossa. Ensi kertaa.
Siis tää, miten tää ei ookaan enää rikki?
Sami fiksas se just.
Sami who?
Meidän talomestari.
Sujuu kuin sato. Vuokraa elämäsi koti. Sato.fi.
Grillimaisterin kuumalinja, Henri Alin.
Moi. Sitä vaan, että onkohan toi mun grilli voinut ruveta vegaaniksi? Sen kansi ei aukea millään.
No, mitä sä oot oikein sinne koittanut laittaa?
Tavallista makkaraa.
Hoho, no tuskin se nyt vegaaniksi on ryhtynyt. Se vaan haluaa parempaa grillattavaa. Haet nyt kuule Lidlistä Grillimaisterin kanansiipi. Niin eiköhän se kansi ala sitä aukea.
Grillimaisteria.
Grillimaisteria.
Grillattavat Lidlistä. Se kannattaa.